From the BBC World Service, this is The Documentary, the home of original storytelling. I'm Ruth Alexander, here with a bonus episode of the podcast I host, The Food Chain. We've been going for 10 years, examining the business, science and cultural significance of what we eat and what it takes to put food on your plate. So this week, we're celebrating the programme's 10th anniversary with a pick of some of our favourite moments from the past decade. Fishing to stay alive, chopping onions in remembrance, and what's so funny about bolognese? Just a few of the stories you'll hear in this eclectic mix. Each tells us something about our relationship with food and how it helps us connect with one another. And just to say, we will be talking about the sensitive topic of bereavement. Let's start with the basics, when food is life or death. In Survival Stories, Fish, Bacon for Breakfast, broadcast in 2016, presenter Emily Thomas spoke to Steve Callahan from the United States.
I'm probably best known for being dumb enough to lose my boat in the middle of the Atlantic and spending the next 2.5 months drifting about 2,000 miles and learning to live like an aquatic caveman.
It happened in 1982 when he was 29. In the aftermath of divorce and business problems, Steve had decided to follow a dream, to build a boat to cross the North Atlantic Ocean. He did it. On his return journey, however, 8 days from the Canary Islands as he headed towards the Caribbean, something struck the boat and it began to sink. Steve inflated a life raft and grabbed whatever he could from the cabin, knowing it would likely be weeks before anyone found him.
I had a can of peanuts, a can of beans, I think it was a half a cabbage, and basically not much else.
Crucially, Steve had some solar cell contraptions which distilled seawater into drinking water, but he still needed to eat. The water was filled with Dorado fish, and he had a spear gun.
I was really hungry. It was one of the times I actually broke down on the raft when I caught the first fish. I couldn't believe at what state of desperation I had been brought to, and it was a really big day for me to catch that food. Initially, I just ate the flesh of the fish, and eventually I'd eat basically the entire contents of fish. Fish liver and fish heart and fish eyes. It interested me at the time how my physiology actually heavily influenced my psychology. By the time I was catching fish, I wasn't eating it because I had to. I was eating it because I really wanted to. And as time went on, I actually got less and less interested in the flesh of the fish and more interested in the organ meats, the eyes, the little disc between the vertebrae, which were nuggets of fluid, and then fresh fish liver became my dessert. I had this whole fantasy going on of different parts of the fish being different things. You know, I'd cut off all the flesh from the backbone and everything hanging up, and that would be like my bacon for breakfast. I was luxuriating every time I caught a fish and had fresh fish guts.
Your only company was the birds and the fish, yet you had to eat them to survive. Was there ever any conflict in your mind there?
Yeah. There was. I had huge conflict within me, and I got very attached to the fish. The way I looked at it was, they're out there playing, hunting, making love, having a good time, and I was dying. They were clearly my superiors in that domain. When you rely on the natural environment, you come to honor them in a totally different way. As far as I was concerned, they were spiritual beings. It got more and more difficult for me to want to catch the fish. They became my friends and companions. I spoke to them. I wooed them in certain ways. Not only did they provide me with sustenance and become my friends, but in the end, they did bring my salvation. Frigate birds would come out and hover over the raft because their chief food is flying fish, which is the chief food of the Dorado. And if they see Dorado around, they know there's a good sign that there are flying fish around. Fishermen came out and they saw these frigate birds hovering in the sky, and they knew, oh, that's a good sign that there are bigger fish out there. So they came out to find the fish, and they found me in the middle of it.
35 years on, has that experience had a lasting impact on how you eat?
There's always in the back of my mind a knowledge and respect for food that I didn't have before. I accept the compromise that it's necessary to eat food and to kill things in order to survive, but I'm very conscious that I'm also taking life.
Steve Callahan, who was rescued near the Caribbean island of Guadeloupe after 76 days, he'd lost a third of his body weight. He went on to write a book about his experience, Adrift, 76 Days Lost at Sea. There are other experiences which can leave us feeling unmoored and at sea. Raw Grief, an episode broadcast in 2018, which won the prestigious James Beard Award for Best Radio Programme, explored our feelings around eating and loss. Emily Thomas spoke to Amy, whose father had died a year earlier, leaving her feeling very alone. She'd sought ways to feel closer to him, visiting places he loved, but there were too many people. Listening to his favourite music, but that seemed banal.
And then food gave me the kind of sensory experience I wanted, specifically raw onion. So he was a massive fan of raw onion. Every meal he had, he'd have a side plate of raw onion. Sometimes we'd cut it up for him if we wanted to spoil him. Otherwise, he did it himself. And he'd sprinkle it on most things. And if I had a friend over and they accepted the offer of onion, he thought they were extremely cool. I started eating raw onion more out of curiosity to see what he liked about it. And partly to eat it on his behalf. So you can't eat it, so I'm going to eat it for you.
Did you like it?
No, but it's such an overpowering taste. And I guess, to be honest, I wanted to feel overcome by some sort of sensory experience.
And is it something you do regularly now?
Yes. I promise I didn't do it today because I knew we'd be in a confined
Thank
space.
But something you do every day or every week?
3 or 4 times a week.
And are there any other foods that you've tried to feel closer to your dad?
He's a big fan of scones, and I really hate scones, but sometimes I force myself to eat them. Again, just to see what he liked about them and to indulge him.
So is this kind of a ritual for you, eating these specific foods, something that you do very privately and quietly, or is it something that you share with other people?
It's extremely private, yeah. No one knows I do it.
Until now.
Until now. Hello, world.
Do you think when you stop doing it, it will be because you've stopped grieving, because that process is over?
I imagine, yeah.
What do you think your dad would have made of this, of you sitting there eating raw onion with your food?
He would love it. The last thing my dad said to me was, "Should we go out to eat?" So I think he would love it.
Amy talking to Emily Thomas. In 2020, many of us were feeling alone as the global coronavirus pandemic suddenly cut us off from friends and family. In the episode My Quarantine Kitchen, broadcast in April of that year, presenter Greer Jackson talked to people about how mealtimes were helping them reconnect with their loved ones and themselves. Here's Gulrokh Nafisi, an artist living in the centre of Iran's capital, Tehran.
In a normal day, you hear cars more than anything else, and then you hear horns and brakes and motorbikes. And people are shouting sometimes. During the quarantine time, it was quite silent, heavy silence. I could hear birds singing. And I could also hear sounds of spoon and forks from the other windows, which are close to my balcony, with the heavy smell of food, of course. In the beginning, I think the first week was just joyful because everything was cancelled. So you had a feeling like a child that school is cancelled, so you can stay at home. But of course, you had lots of stress and anxiety at the same time because Iran was one of the first countries that was confronting with everything. So news were really horrifying, and I had the feeling that we are the only one in the world after China. But then I saw my friends are sending recipes, they record their voices, and it was also like a love message for me, because it was a beautiful request, and also it was a reaction to panic and anxiety, because the kitchen became a place that you could feel relaxed because you were doing something with your hand and you could concentrate on something essential.
Was the kitchen like that for you before? Was it a place where you felt very calm and relaxed?
It wasn't relaxing place. I remember I used to enjoy a lot to cook for my friends, but it was more like party time. It wasn't a basic need. It wasn't meditating or healing. Now cooking is an act of healing.
Gorok also found herself enjoying a sense of solidarity with those living close by.
It's often that your neighbors in other side of Iran, not in Tehran, they bring food for you. If they cook sweets or for some religious events, they bring a bit of food to you. But in Tehran, you don't see it always, or it's not really common. But my neighbors brought sweets for me. And I remember when I was a child, my mom used to put another food or sweet in the same plate to bring back the plate. So I did it like I remembered, and I was like, yeah, I know the answer. I also have to do something. So I baked cake and I put it in the same plate.
Really? So you've now got a food relationship with your neighbors.
Yeah, exactly. She also criticized my cake, and I appreciate that. She was like, yeah, it was good, but it was a bit dry. And I felt, wow, so close, you know, we don't need to say, oh, thank you very much. We are so stuck together that we can't even criticize each other.
Gulrokh Nafisi in Tehran. Food often becomes an intense focus in times of crisis. In 2021, we brought together two people from opposite sides of the world's deadliest ever conflict to share their memories of wartime food. Ingeborg Schreib-Wiewiorski was a young girl living in Berlin when World War II broke out. Beryl Kingston was in London and remembers food rationing being introduced in 1940 when she was 9 years old.
We had to register with a grocer's for all our groceries that were rationed, and with a butcher for the meat. And we couldn't go anywhere else other than that butcher and grocer to buy food, because they got the food to match our ration books. The ration book was actually all labelled, so that you had butter ration, margarine, sugar, tea. They chopped a little coupon out and gave you the tea. And then you had a series of points that you could use, 5 points or 10 or whatever it was, to buy tinned food, like tinned salmon or anything there was.
Ingeborg, what was the situation in Berlin in the early years of the war?
As much as I remember was that we had enough to eat till to 43, 44. And then it started with rationalizing. At the end of the war, then it really started to become very hard. And especially in the winter of 46, 47, we had a lot of hunger. And many people died of hunger in Berlin. Yeah, we had these carts too, but that wasn't enough to have. So we had to sell glasses or furs or carpets to have money to buy. For example, we had to change then our piano for 100 pounds of potatoes.
You exchanged your piano for a few bags of potatoes?
Yes. Or my mother sold her crystal glasses to buy butter, for example, or to buy carrots or wild turnips.
Beryl, looking back now,
from a time when you know, there's plentiful food, what were some of the worst things you were eating, even if you were grateful for it at the time?
Acorns.
Acorns?
Yes.
From the tree? From the oak
yes.
tree?
Yes, oh yes. After the meal, I was always hungry, even after I'd had my midday meal, because it was small. The meat we had was a little tiny slice, I mean, razor thin, and although we had plenty of dehydrated potato, which we called pom, and overcooked cabbage, which was very wet and watery, and occasionally baked beans, the meal actually didn't satisfy. And I used to sit out in the school grounds and pick the acorns off and put them in, chew them, and that gave me something else to eat. Peculiar.
And you eat that? We had that for coffee.
Did you? You were having...
The icons instead of real coffee in Germany.
So you were drinking acorns?
Yes, icon coffee.
What effect has this extraordinary experience of food limitations and hardship had on you subsequently in later life? I mean, are there food habits you have which you can trace back to these times of rationing?
We cannot throw away food until today, until my old ages. And many of my colleagues know the same. We cannot throw away any food. We buy as much as we just need to have. We are very careful with food.
Beryl, is that the same for you?
Yes, very much. I wouldn't waste food ever, yeah, because it's like a sin. I can't throw food away.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yes, that's it. That's exactly how you feel. You think, oh, I can't waste this. I'll turn this into something else. I'll make a soup or something like that.
Beryl Kingston and Ingeborg Schreib-Wiewiorski. If you're enjoying our 10th anniversary special and would like to hear more episodes on everything from how much water you should drink to the realities of taking weight loss drugs, search for BBC The Food Chain wherever you found this podcast. I'm Ruth Alexander, and this is The Food Chain from the BBC World Service. This week, we're celebrating our 10th anniversary with some of our favourite moments over the decade, which each reveals something about our relationship with food.
Hello.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm Ruth.
Hello, Ruth.
In the winter of 2022, I was welcomed out of an icy cold Northern England evening and into the warm, homely kitchen of Brian and Julie Lamb, who live near Blackburn, with, since May of that year, Maria Dmitrienko and her children. Maria, Christina, age 13, and Artem, age 7, had come from Ukraine, leaving behind their home, their business, and the rest of their family. They told me how the first meal they'd all shared together had been an icebreaker.
Has to bake with made with a bolognese sauce.
Yeah, I remember this.
Why are you laughing? What's so funny about pasta bake?
Because Artem wouldn't stop eating it. He just kept eating it and going,
gesturing for
more. And then when he'd had three helpings, he held up his hand like, stop.
Because he couldn't talk, he didn't know a language, so he just was hands. It was delicious.
Yeah. You were all hungry.
Yeah, it was a big journey. Oh, it was nice.
And has food, has it proven a way to get to know one another? Are you cooking for one another, sharing British dishes, Ukrainian dishes?
Everything, don't we? The other week, Julie made a traditional roast beef and all the trimmings, Yorkshire puddings, roast potatoes, all the vegetables. So this lot...
This lot. You mean our lovely guests?
The Yorkshire pudding with salad.
With salad? That's novel.
Cucumber and tomatoes.
Yeah.
For the uninitiated, what you generally do with a Yorkshire pudding is, or you'd have gravy on it, some meat inside it perhaps, but yeah, it's a warm,
Oh, they,
batter.
They did that.
They have salad with every meal.
Yeah.
So we've got some fusion.
Yes.
I've got
food
say,
going on here. New ideas.
You like cucumber and tomato with every meal.
Yeah, usually.
Julie and Brian were also getting to try Ukrainian foods thanks to Maria and the family she'd had to leave behind in Ukraine.
Your parents sent over their own honey.
Oh,
which
yeah.
Which was lovely.
Yeah, my dad has a few houses with bee...
Beehives,
yeah. So he does honey. So when we had a parcel from Ukraine with small things, they put a jar of honey from home.
To me, that meant so much, you know. They're in such a situation, and yet they sent that over to us.
They sent a food parcel.
Brian, Julie and Maria, whose parents have since been able to join them in England. The significance of providing family food with love was a theme in Africa's Forgotten Foods, an episode broadcast in 2023, which explored how indigenous dishes were becoming hard to source and prepare as more people moved to cities and away from their extended families. Here's reporter Michael Koloki getting a lesson in how to make the traditional maize dish Nzenga from his auntie Naomi in Nairobi, Kenya.
Okay, auntie, you've been cooking for me for years. So I told you today it's me to do the work. So what do I need to do to make these pieces of maize smaller?
I'll give you a mortar. You pour this inside. Then I'll give you a pestle. Then
basically hit it.
You hit.
Yeah, I can see the work is lining up here for me. Here goes. And I remember I used to do this when I was a little one. There I go. So now I am pounding this maize. And it takes quite a bit of energy. Okay, my auntie is taking over here. I think she seems to think I'm not making much progress. Hey, auntie, you're doing it so well. Hey. So, Nzenga is ready now. You want me to taste first? Auntie, as you know, in our culture, I'm not supposed to eat before you.
Let me taste.
Okay. All right, auntie, so you taste, you're cooking, I should say I contributed a bit, and tell me what you think.
It's sweet.
Okay, auntie says it's sweet. Okay, so let me taste mine. It's kind of brings interesting memories to me because it's something I last tasted many years ago. Mm. Auntie, why do you think people are not making Nzenga that much anymore?
I think it has been taken over by rice and other food varieties.
I think that when I was growing up, I remember that it wasn't that easy to get rice as it is now.
It was quite expensive and very few families would afford it.
It was one of those foods that you just didn't eat every day. So instead, people used to make Nzenga.
Yes. I think even the millers are not doing it as commonly as before. They say they don't do it anymore.
So when you actually even go to buy the maize to make the Nzenga, the millers say, we don't have it.
Yes, they don't make. I think they don't have many customers for Nzenga.
So I better finish the food here as well and not leave anything on the plate. There's that look you used to give us back in the day when we did not finish our food. You know, that look that said, you better finish that food on the plate, Michael. you know it, auntie. You know that, remember that
remember,
look?
I do remember.
So you used to do it. You were aware.
If you do it now, I will still give it to you.
Okay.
Let it go off me.
Michael Koloki and his auntie Naomi in Kenya. As well as strengthening family bonds and passing culinary culture down the generations, food can help forge the firmest of friendships.
Antonio!
Yeah?
Come here, come here, come here, come here, come here!
This is TV chef Gennaro Contaldo with the late restaurateur Antonio Carluccio foraging for mushrooms in their native Italy for the BBC TV series Two Greedy Italians, made by Fresh One Productions in 2011.
Collect them. Bring some to me.
Antonio, there's so many.
Now you are a donkey, you can carry them.
They'd both spent their culinary careers in the UK. When they met, they formed an instant bond, as Gennaro told us in the episode Food Double Acts, broadcast in April this year.
There was something which attracted us so much. He was the father figure to me. Our relationship, I was extremely close.
You became like his right-hand man.
That's what he keeps saying. And I would say, no, right hands, left hands. You want my make? I say, because everything he was doing, I was doing it.
You made a television series together, didn't you, in 2011 and 2012? It looks like you're covering your face with your hands, but it looked like you were having enormous fun together.
It was so much fun. At some time, we don't know what we was doing. Actually, not sometime. Most of the time.
The sauce is burning.
Oh, don't worry. The sauce is not burning. I am cooking. I am in charge. You eat it, okay? We were enjoying it. You know, it's two oldish boy going holiday for 3 years. It was an holiday, back and forward. Yeah, I can't wait it.
Two friends on holiday.
It was a joy. It is a joy, incredible, joyful. You know, we couldn't wait to leave England and to go in Italy and discover, in the same time we were discovering new things. We really went for it.
And then, very sadly, in 2017, Antonio died. It made headline news. How would you describe the loss you felt personally?
I can't remember that moment. For a fraction of seconds, so many memories went through. A flash of a memory of 20, 35 years that went one after the other. And I dropped everything. I left everything straight to see Antonio. It was bad. I missed him. Oh, God, I missed him. He was more than a friend. It was more than a friend.
You've also had a successful partnership with the chef Jamie Oliver. Would you say that things you learned from Antonio passed through you onto Jamie?
I guess many things passed me to Jamie. Jamie is like a son. Of course, I have many children. I love them all. And I love them eagles. I take Jamie as my own.
What's it been like watching your protege, Jamie's career, take off?
I love it. Do you know what? I look at him and everything he's doing, I just feel that's me. Yes, yes, do. Yeah, that's me. It's a little bit of me in him.
It's been lovely to hear about these two close friendships you've enjoyed. Do you think there's something about working with food that means professional relationships can quickly become friendships and really close, firm friendships?
I'll tell you in one word. Yes, it is. And do you know what it is? Sharing. It's like you eating a pizza. You share it with a friend you most love.
Gennaro Contaldo, ending this 10-year anniversary edition of The Food Chain. If you'd like to hear more episodes, search for BBC The Food Chain wherever you get your BBC podcasts. And if there's something you'd like us to talk about or look into for a future edition, please do email thefoodchain@bbc.co.uk. From me and all of the team, past and present, thanks for listening.